Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Creek.
And we are collectively the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in and around New York City. And our show aims to bring some culture to horticulture, which in this nation is sorely lacking. So today's show is part two of our multi-part series on America's horticultural heritage. And in honor of President's Day, today's show touches on our founding fathers' focus on farming and horticulture as the basis of our nation's identity and future prosperity. We're also going to touch on the First Ladies as an influence on the nation's horticulture. And we have a special guest for that, Robin Selfridge. On the second part of the show, we take on the future presidents, whoever that may be, still up in the air, as it's campaign season.
Dun, dun, dun.
I know. If we have anything to say about it, maybe after today people will be influenced in some way. So it's campaign season. We thought it was fitting that we learn a little bit about the candidates from a horticultural perspective. But first we have to start with two men that we're remembering today, George Washington, our first president, and Abraham Lincoln, our 16th president, both of whom celebrate their birthdays this month, and they've been kind of consolidated into President's Day.
Yes.
So Alice is going to talk about these two guys from a horticultural point of view.
So today is President's Day, and it's February, and it's really interesting, actually, that it is horticulture that brings the two birthdays together. And the culmination is the Land Grant Act. And I'm going to tell you how it comes to that. But let's start with our old friend G.W., George Washington, right?
Great guy.
The founder, the first independent candidate,
yes.
Right? I think we're on the verge of another independent candidate,
yeah.
Perhaps, with this election. Washington really was extremely pivotal in using horticulture as kind of the basis for democracy. Last week on the show, we talked about Prince's Nursery, which was the very first garden center and commercial garden purchasing
in America.
In America, in Flushing, Queens. And when Washington was fighting the Revolutionary battle, he actually spent a lot of time at Prince's Nursery. And he spent a majority of time during that battle actually thinking of his home in Virginia, Mount Vernon. So here's I've got a couple of quotes, and I want to talk a little bit about Washington and his thoughts and how horticulture influenced him as a human. So Washington was, you know, he was a farmer. He came from a farming background in Virginia. And the ideology of Washington is that the future of America should lay in the fields and the forests. And the design of Mount Vernon, which was his home on the Potomac, really epitomizes that. He spent countless hours poring over plant lists. He was buying from Prince's Nursery. He was buying from John Bartram and really organizing Mount Vernon as an Acadian landscape, from a farm to an Acadian landscape. And he really saw this as the kind of vision for what America should be and for how Americans should live. And it was always through a farming and horticultural perspective. Mount Vernon is Washington's desire to be a mirror of the revolutionary ideology. So it was native trees, it was hedges, and the tearing down of hedges. It was a departure from the English style, an ornamental garden that would be planted with native species. So he was away from Mount Vernon for about 8 years, but there are countless letters, and there's an amazing book that Andrea Wolfe wrote about the Founding Fathers called The Founding Gardeners. And there's excerpts of those letters and his seed lists and the plants that he saw as he traveled around that he wanted to bring back to Mount Vernon. There's another great book by Matt Griswold called Making a Landscape, and it's the design of Washington's gardens at Mount Vernon, Landscape of the Inner Man. And both of these books are fantastic references for Washington.
And I'm glad that we're focusing. A lot of people know about Monticello,
right,
and Thomas Jefferson, and he's associated with American horticulture very much. But people don't make the same, I think, associations with Washington, because they
right.
focus on him as a military leader, as the first president. But he was a gentleman farmer first.
He was first.
And foremost.
Exactly.
And still.
And he was a surveyor, you know.
Yeah.
He was also extremely instrumental in the design of the White House and the Capitol and the layout. And he really envisioned a botanical garden in the center of the city and a university. So his ideology of horticulture and mechanics and animal husbandry as a part of everyday life for Americans really sets the tone. You know, he had more vision almost than Jefferson. I think Jefferson actually had more of the display with Monticello because he traveled more. But I think he really got that idea, I think, from George Washington. So,
and George knew that, you know, once he became president, people would be visiting his home. It would be very
right.
important to demonstrate the nation's strength, independence, economically and otherwise.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So he put a lot of thought into that.
Oh yeah, and it consumed him. He was away for 8 years during the Revolution, but there were 3 to 4 letters a week written back to Martha and to others about Mount Vernon. So that occupied, you know, here he is like leading the charge, right? And he's thinking about which plants and seeds and
I love it.
The layout of Mount Vernon as an emblem of what America should be achieving.
Yeah, and that's such a hopeful idea because as you're going through, there were so many points during the Revolutionary War where it seemed like we weren't going to win.
No, he was a pioneer farmer.
Yeah.
Was really what he was.
But the fact that he was planning, he's like, I'm going to go back to that.
Right.
To me, that says, Alice, he's going to win and he's going to get back to his land. Right?
Yeah. Here's a quote from the Andrea Wolfe book. As the war intensified in the months and years that followed the Battle of New York, Washington's dedication to his garden and plants did not abate. Sometimes new planting schemes seemed to occupy his thoughts more than the desperate situation of the country and the men. In December 1776, he wrote, I tremble for Philadelphia. But just a few short lines later in the same letter, it runs in my head that I have heard of some objection to the sycamore. Washington always longed for his estate manager's infinitely amusing letters, because they were horticultural, and I think it was a break from the drama
of
the war.
Yeah, the responsibility.
And for Washington, trees were, another quote from Andrew Wolfe, for Washington, trees were both a glorious expression of America's beauty and a political trope. It was a tree that had become the most striking emblem of the Revolution, the Liberty Tree, which, as Thomas Paine wrote in his poem, was the temple of the revolutionaries. So significant was the old elm in Boston that many old specimens in towns across America had been designated as Liberty Trees. Similarly, during the early years of the war, the schooners with which Washington defended Boston against the British carried flags that depicted a green pine tree with the inscription, "An Appeal to Heaven." So when Washington describes his lack of funds to pay his soldiers as an axe at the tree of our safety, interest, and liberty, he used trees as metaphors in the struggle. Hmm. So he really looked at the world through horticultural eyes.
Yeah.
And I think the design of our capital and his ideology of university and botanical gardens next to the capital, like physically, you know, positioned next to the capitals, was really instrumental with where our country should be headed.
Right.
And so then that takes us to
Lincoln.
Lincoln.
Yes.
And you talk about the most positive president, right?
Right.
The Lincoln, so Lincoln was born in 1809 in Kentucky, and his kind of, one of the quotes that most accompanies Lincoln is, "I want it said of me by those who knew me best that I always picked a thistle and I planted a flower where I thought a flower should grow." Now, this is a man whose mother died when he was 9 years old from an ingestion of poisoned milk from a cow that actually grazed into a field that hadn't been properly farmed. So here's his mother dying from this, like, horticultural anomaly, right? And yet he still sees the benefit of horticulture as a symbolism. He was not a gardener, per se, but he was, of course, from farming roots.
Yeah.
And another great quote was, "We can complain because rose bushes have thorns, or we can rejoice because thorn bushes have roses," which is a really nice way of looking at the world. He had barely a year's worth of school in the traditional sense. He was completely self-taught. His lifelong mentor and hero was George Washington, and his favorite book was The Life of George Washington with Curious Anecdotes, equally honorable to himself and exemplary to his young countrymen. That was George's, or that was Lincoln's favorite book, and he took it everywhere he went. He read it several times.
And he worked, Alice, I believe, as a field hand or a farmer before he went
He was actively involved in farming, but it was more for subsistence farming, not in the gardening sense as George Washington or Jefferson.
But he did get the value of it. He did get it at a deep level.
He definitely did, and he was a very awkward man
and depressive too.
Depressed.
I've read.
At their house in Illinois, they did not have a garden, but Mary's sister, Mary Washington's sister, would come yearly and plant flowers because she thought it appropriate that they have flowers at the front. Mary Lincoln's sister planted flowers yearly in front of the house.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
That sounds like what I do.
But but I also wanted to read a little bit about what the White House grounds looked like when the Lincolns lived there.
Okay.
So in 1862, the grounds about the president's house are tastefully adorned with artificial mounds, gravels, walks, trees, and a fountain. Appended to the main building at either end are long, low ranges of stalls with flat roofs, which are used for various household purposes. The one on the west is surmounted by a beautiful glass house, which is filled with exotic plants. The public approach the president's house on the north side, except for on Wednesdays and evenings in the summer, when a sort of out-of-door reception is given, accompanied with music in the grounds on the south side. The entrance from the north porch is in a long vestibule through which the visitor passes to the right into the president's reception room. So this communicates with the round room formed on the South Bow Front. And this was a square room which adjoins the East Room. So there's gardens around these various entrances, as there is today. But the fact that this was designed, you know, via George Washington, and then, you know, the public is coming and entering, you know, these sacred spaces through these gardens. So you can't ignore the influence of horticulture and the optimism that horticulture brings.
Yeah. It's true. And in the West, where the West Wing is now, were the glass houses, right? They were growing. They had their own commercial sort of growing operation where they grew a lot of their own annuals at the height. And they had a lot of people dedicated to doing that.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, there were gardeners.
Yeah.
And still beyond the rough undergrowth and the marsh to the river, because remember, Washington is a swamp.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was rough living because of the swampy conditions. But there was always a real country garden with peach trees and strawberries. It was often said that Mrs. Lincoln would bring strawberry cuttings in and use them on the tables.
Oh, interesting.
And she loved roses, and her kind of signature gift to guests was a bouquet of roses.
Oh, that's always very sweet.
Yeah, hand them out. And then the thing with Lincoln that we can't ignore is he really took the idea of a university that George Washington proposed and made it into fruition with the Morrell Act of 1862, which was the land grant ideology of land for education, that each state would be given some public land to create the universities. And these universities were to specialize in agriculture and horticulture and mechanics and military tactics. So it's all extremely tied together.
So the reason that many of us have had the opportunity to go to school in our state, to our state university, we can thank Lincoln.
Yeah.
You know,
and Washington.
And Washington.
So just one more thing, because there's a great garden actually in Springfield, Illinois, which is the Lincoln
homestead.
The Lincoln. It's not the homestead, but it is a garden, and it's the Lincoln Memorial Garden. It was designed in 1936 by Jens Jensen, who was really one of the very early conservationists. He came from the Prairie School. And he was a contemporary of Frank Lloyd Wright. And it's a native garden designed to illustrate the plants of the three states where Lincoln grew up, in Kentucky and Illinois and Indiana. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. And it's filled with hickories and oaks and maples and native perennials and prairie grasses. And it's really the plants that Lincoln would have grown up with as a young boy, you know, and it's where he would have read some of the great books and done his studying. You know, he was from very, very, very poor, meager educational background, and he spent all of his time outdoors. So I think it's very fitting that this garden exists.
It sounds like a great place to visit.
And yeah, so there's our two presidents and their nutshell horticultural
there's so much more. We're going to list some of the books, a little bibliography on our Facebook page so that people can read on. But we have a special guest with us today, Robin Selfridge, who, full disclosure, also happens to be my husband. But besides that qualification, is an avid collector of coins and stamps, as well as an artist, educator, and the person most likely to broach presidential politics in mixed company.
And I know, because I've been on the receiving end of that conversation.
Yes, he will speak to anyone. He loves to discuss and debate in a friendly, amicable manner with anybody on all sides. So Robin Selfridge, especially now, is really into the presidential dollar coins. And he's going to talk about...
And he's manufactured
He's designed and minted a few.
Yeah.
But he reminded me that we have to talk about the ladies.
Yes.
The first ladies were often very much associated with horticulture, with flowers and that kind of thing. That's not something that most presidents, other than perhaps the early ones, focused on. So, Robin, why don't you tell us a little bit about how the coins tell us about the plants and their presence.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Well, first, I did spend all morning sorting the latest presidential dollar coin, so I brought you Richard Nixon.
Here's Excellent.
Richard Nixon dollar coin. Carmen, I'm going to get that one back.
Thank you.
So,
I don't know.
I just put this in my pocket.
I need to feed the meter.
These are the dollar coins. I feel are the quarters of tomorrow. Soon, I mean, in Midtown, it's what
50
cents for 6 minutes.
Yeah.
So, you know, throw in a dollar coin. What was the question?
So you've been collecting. Let me just get our reader, our listeners up to speed. You've been collecting coins since you were a little boy in Kansas.
Right. And I kind of got back into it with the state quarters.
Uh-huh.
I noticed, the back of the quarters are different. And then I started getting into the dollar coins because I love the presidents. And a lot of people might not know, but as they put out the dollar coins that for circulation starting in 2007, they also put out gold and bronze likenesses of the first ladies. And
right.
So there's a first spouse series that comes out just slightly after each president. They've been doing four presidents a year. And then the first spouse comes out a little bit after that. Only a couple times there have been a couple presidents who had two spouses. One had died.
Right.
And so they get a couple coins. And when a president was widowed, or the one bachelor president, they did some a liberty, they said, with Lady Liberty as emblematic as shown on the coins of the day, something at the same time when he was president. So I looked on the back of my first spouse medals collection, and I noticed that there are five ladies who the reverse of their medal actually depicts flowers.
Okay, so tell us who.
So the first spouse to have flowers is Carolyn Harrison, President Benjamin Harrison's wife. And
what year was that?
Let's see. It was between the Clevelands.
Okay.
Because Cleveland was president once and then not reelected, and he got to be president again. It would be 1889 to 1893.
So that's the height of the Victorian era.
Mm-hmm. So. Right. And she painted everything, including China. So they have a picture of an orchid and some paintbrushes on the back of her coin. This was interesting. I found on the U.S. Mint website about the coin that she would decorate things like candlesticks, milk sets, platters, other pieces, as well as those owned by women in Washington wanting a little White House memento. So you would go take her a piece of your china and she would paint a flower on it.
That's
and
so she, cool.
That's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Fittingly, she was also the first lady who organized the pieces of past presidential china into a collection. So when you go and you see the collection, it's because of her efforts to organize them.
Well, that seems very ladylike and appropriate.
It does.
I agree.
It does. The next spouse to have a floral arrangement on the back of her coin was Helen Taft. And she is best known for the Japanese cherry trees around the Tidal Basin.
Right.
Which were a gift from the mayor of Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently she was very instrumental in helping that happen. And she planted the first two trees herself in March of 1912.
And some of that same benefaction, some of those same trees came to Brooklyn Public Library.
Yes.
Or Brooklyn Botanic Garden.
Brooklyn Botanic Garden.
Yes.
That's interesting. Interesting connection.
Yeah.
Nice. The third floral reverse of a coin is Ellen Wilson's. That would be the first wife of Woodrow Wilson. She died from Bright's disease. I had to look that up. It's like a kidney problem while he was president. So, but she's probably best known for initiating and overseeing the creation of the famous White House Rose Garden.
Wilson's wife did that.
Mm-hmm.
Wilson's first wife. Okay.
The second one on the reverse of her coin, it shows her helping somebody with a cane. So that's what she was for. The one I remember as a kid, because I was a stamp collector too, and I remember all the stamps, you know, beautify our cities, beautify our roads, you know, and they'd show flowers next to the highway and stuff.
Right, right.
So that, of course, was Lady Bird Johnson. And during LBJ's presidency, she kept a daily journal, created the first ladies' committee for a more beautiful capital, and then expanded her beautification program to include the entire nation. It says on the website.
Lucky us.
Yeah, she's going to beautify the entire nation.
Yeah.
That's
but I guess
amazing.
She started in the Capitol.
That's cool.
And finally, Jacqueline Kennedy. Here, I'll read this right from the Mint's website. The reverse features the species of saucer magnolia Mrs. Kennedy chose to be planted in the White House garden and near the eternal flame at her husband's grave at Arlington National Cemetery. The petals stretch across the globe, its tips connecting the points of some of her most notable diplomatic visits.
That's very interesting.
That is interesting because the southern magnolia is not the most hardiest of plants.
Yeah.
Right. I guess it's marginally...
Yeah.
Washington is kind of...
It's the threshold, probably.
Of where it can go.
I mean, we plant them up here, but
it's
we have to wrap them.
Yeah.
It's
a little risky.
Very dicey
up here. We try it.
Global warming is helping.
Yeah.
So we have to talk about TR. We have to take a break.
Okay.
When we come back, we want to talk about my personal favorite president,
Mr. Roosevelt.
TR, and we're also celebrating the 100th anniversary of the national parks.
That's right.
So stay tuned to We Dig Plants.
And this one's called Third Degree Rug Burns by Tax Star. We'll be right back. Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you.
Welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We're here with Robin Selfridge talking about presidents and plants.
Yeah.
So,
and coins.
And coins. So, Robin, TR, Teddy Roosevelt, and the national parks.
Right. I think it's the 100th anniversary of the national parks
this year.
So, of course, some coins are going to be coming out, some commemorative coins for celebrating TR and that. The thing coin collectors will remember is, you know, the quarters right now have their ATB quarters, they're called, America the Beautiful quarters. And so the back is a little vignette, a little representation of either a national park or a national historic site or something national that's recognized in each state, and each state got to pick one. And a lot of coin collectors were advocating that TR be put on the front of the coin for that. But
I would have voted for that.
Right, because, you know, he's responsible for it. And the quarters are actually... They actually were released five a year in the order that the park became a national site.
Okay.
So it started with, what was the first one? Was it Yosemite? No, actually, it was Hot Springs, Arkansas, I think.
That
was
the first national park?
I believe it was a national monument or site. Maybe it's Slim Pickens down there to come up with one to represent on the coin.
Wait, is that the guy's name, Slim Pickens?
Yeah,
or?
I think it was.
What do we got down here?
The quarters, I think, are very... there were some really attractive coins compared to the state quarters from before. Because, you know, these are just nice pictures of natural scenes and some of the flora and fauna of the park. And the state quarters were more like, you know, state flags where, you know, let's make sure to put a sugar beet on it. And how about a diamond? And Helen Keller is from here.
Yeah.
So they like all try to cram stuff onto the
Is there
the
a
same
Bartram
quarter.
Coin at all?
Is Bartram on any? He was Pennsylvania, right? He was Philadelphia.
Not that I know of.
No, that would be a good suggestion. I mean, what an American, right? I mean, that's interesting that he isn't represented.
Right.
I guess Philadelphia has an abundance of symbolic and
Yeah.
things. So Bartram didn't come up.
Well, the Liberty Bell. How do you compete with the Liberty Bell?
You can't.
So you're saying that the quarters are really nicely designed in terms of the
artistically.
Yeah. And a good representation of the parks or the monuments of each state.
Yeah, there are some attractive quarters. They actually have been putting out, if you're interested in stacking silver in this economy, they've been putting out 5-ounce versions of them.
That's huge.
Yeah. They look a little, the collectors call them hockey pucks.
That's very
but
big.
They're not that attractive when you blow up something designed for a quarter to 5-ounce size, but it's kind of fun to have a few. And some of them actually look good blown up, like El Capitan.
Yes, El Capitan looks good. And I love the quarter, and I think Puerto Rico, was that right, Rob? Puerto Rico has a national park.
Right. Well, that one hasn't come out. That was for the after the state. After the states, then they did the territories. So they got a quarter, and instead of making it all busy, they did just pick some. What's their flower? There was some flower, and then the picture of that one building that they. What was it? The fort.
The fort. Right. Yes, of course. Yeah. That was a really handsome one. I remember that because it stood out because of the tropical foliage and everything.
Now, do you have all the states? As a collector,
I have. Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah. I have all the presidents.
What's your favorite?
My favorite state?
Yeah.
Well, design-wise, Wyoming looks good because it's not cluttered. It's just got, a guy on a horse. It's got their logo.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. The most cluttered one, the worst one, is Arkansas. It's got a do they mine diamonds in Arkansas?
They might.
I think so.
It's got a diamond on it. And it's got a pelican, and it's got a... Or was that Louisiana? I don't remember. They're all...
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of stuff crammed on the back of that little quarter.
So, Robin, you were also telling me about the olive branch
national
symbol.
Well, before the
that was really
state quarter program, the olive branch symbolizes peace. So if you look on the presidential seal, you have the olive branch and arrows symbolizing the two ways these diplomacy can go. And supposedly, the olive branch is in the right hand because...
The right hand of God.
Well, symbolizing that, peace first. You try something peaceful first, and then if not, then you kill them.
Right.
But if you look on the back of any quarter, which was actually started as a commemorative quarter for Washington's birthday in 1932 and then became a regular thing because people dug it. But if you look on the back of the quarter, you'll see that the arrows are in both hands. And then the olive branch is like draped at the feet. So it's like on this bed of peace, we will either kill you or kill you.
Yeah.
And when did that happen?
1932.
That's interesting. So that's right before World War II. Mm-hmm. So a kind of cultural shift perhaps happened.
And it's a very small detail. I mean, you can say, maybe it's not a big deal, but...
Maybe it's not. Yeah. Or maybe it is.
But if... Depends
on which art historian you're talking to.
Right. But, symbolism is a little thing. And so if it means something that the arrows are in the right hand on the presidential seal, it must mean something, too, that they're not on the quarter.
Yes.
Well, that's what I mean. These are not light. This is not...
Light changes.
No. These are very deliberate.
Right.
Several meetings, lots of money paid to a lot of different, designers and fabricators to see how the ethos is going to read.
A lot of people are going to be touching that money. A lot of people are going to be looking at it, evaluating. Right. It is very important, even though it's small details, like you said, Robin.
Yeah.
And actually, it reminded me of the Jackie O, I guess Jacqueline Kennedy for a spouse coin. I mean, that's a great symbol where they were able to make something significant out of...
You mean with the magnolias and the points?
With the magnolia touching points on the map superimposed over the globe.
Right.
And you do think of that time period where America really was flexing its muscle, and touching a lot of different places in ways that we hadn't touched before.
Yeah. But it's interesting that they used a southern magnolia. I wonder why that...
She was not a southern girl.
No.
Right? She was kind of a... Wasn't she from...
Where was she from?
Was she from New England? I thought she was a blue blood kind of...
She grew up in Marywood near Washington, D.C.
Oh, so she was...
Well...
Right on...
She should have known better. than to plant a magnolia there.
Yeah,
no, it's iffy. Okay, I mean it's.
No, I mean that there definitely are.
So I wonder if she thought of herself as a Southerner. That's very interesting.
Could be.
Know?
Yeah.
Is there anything else, Robin, that you've gleaned from your coin world that you think might be of interest?
No.
Okay. Well, that leads me to the future.
Yeah.
Right?
So I can say about the future.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the future.
That why what I've based my political, what my vote is going to be for.
Oh, yes, that is very important.
It's
please.
Very important because, you know, some people, they have special interests and they vote that way no matter what. Well, my special interest is imagine the four coin set. When eventually, you know, eventually as presidents die.
So you're thinking they as a will curator. Be getting,
right. Eventually, as when a president dies, right now they're only doing presidents that have been dead at least 2 years. So we're going to skip Jimmy Carter and go right to Ronald Reagan, and then it's going to be the end of the series. But, you know, I imagine they'll celebrate them with a coin as each president dies. And so eventually there'll be a Bill Clinton coin with a Hillary first spouse coin, and then flip it. Have a Hillary coin with a Bill Clinton first spouse set.
Interesting.
So you are basing
your vote. So that'd be the four
vote.
Coin set. Hillary, Bill, and Hillary. Uh-huh. And that's what I'm voting for. Yes.
Only because you're thinking of the value of the coin.
Right, right.
And and it's called the first spouse. It's not called the first lady series.
No, it's called first spouse.
Because they're anticipating someday there being a female president.
So that would be great if Bill was the first
one.
It
could also mean that someday we might have a gay president. And then,
I never even thought of that.
Right.
Interesting.
I mean,
and
it's called first spouse.
Yes.
Right. Although,
that's true too.
First partner.
Weren't there rumors
first
about Lincoln?
First partner coin. Lincoln?
I hate to say it. Weren't there rumors? Yeah. He slept with the man for a little while.
What?
Lincoln did?
Yeah. That's what
you
I
mean,
read.
Not his brother? Or so? Like he was just sharing a room?
Yeah. I think he just shared a bed.
All of a sudden, Jack, our engineer, is sitting up a little straighter and he's paying attention to the show.
Right.
This is getting interesting.
Right. Well, that's just what I heard. It's probably an internet thing.
I'm going to kind of look into that. I'm very curious now. But the future. Okay, so we focused.
So let's talk about the what you see is not what you get.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
So this is a campaign season. It's a very kind of surreal, I think, campaign season. We've got polar opposites. We've got all kinds of interesting characters. And we have to talk about them. Okay, now, I'm not a political pundit, so I decided to focus on plants. What I know.
Well,
which is
symbolism.
Plants.
Let's talk about symbolism.
Symbolism, okay? So we talked about the nation and flowers, and every state has a state tree and a state flower. So how do we get to know these candidates, right? We get to know them by maybe where they're from, because we don't know what they're going to do.
Right.
They say they're going to do things, but we don't know. So I was inspired by Magritte, René Magritte, who was a surrealist, 20th century surrealist painter. And one of his most famous paintings is called Son of Man, which he painted in 1964. It's a very, very famous image. If you don't know the painting, it's a portrait of a man in a bowler hat, but the man's face is mostly obscured by a green apple that's floating in front of his face. So you can kind of see the man, but you can't.
Is that a Granny Smith?
I don't know. That's a good point. Horticulturally speaking, I don't know the answer. Here's what Magritte said about the painting that I thought was very telling and very appropriate for this campaign season. And he said, at least it hides the face partly well. So you have the apparent face, the apple, hiding the visible but hidden, the face of the person. It's something that happens constantly. Everything we see hides another thing. And we always want to see what is hidden by what we see. There is an interest in that which is hidden and which the visible does not show us. This interest can take the form of a quite intense feeling, a sort of conflict, one might say, between the visible that is hidden and the visible that is present. So doesn't that say everything about presidential politics?
Sure.
It's just like...
That's exactly what we're trying to decide as we watch these crazy debates.
Exactly. What are they saying? What do they mean? So what I decided to do was to take portraits of the presidents and superimpose their state flower on their face. And Alice and I, are...
Because we don't have enough time on our hands.
Hey, it's winter, right? So, and I thought it'd be a fun exercise and kind of see if the flower represents the man or woman
right.
at all. Okay? So in no particular order, and by the way, Alice and I are going to post these portraits, these presidential plan portraits, on our
this
Facebook
exercise
page.
Exercise in Photoshop.
Exactly. later this week. Okay, so we're going to start in no particular, actually in one particular order, but I thought it was random, so I'm not going to reveal any political leanings. We're going to start with Florida. Okay, Marco Rubio. He's from Florida. The state flower of Florida is the orange blossom.
That's right.
Okay? Now, that's got a lot of different levels, a lot of meanings. The orange is useful and beautiful and fragrant. So what do you guys think? Is that a good representation of Marco Rubio? You know, listeners, feel free to chime in.
Yes. I don't know. Orange sounds more Trump to me.
Does it? That's true. Okay. What do you think, Alice? Think he's it's a good, you know, it's round.
The jury's out.
Juicy.
The jury's a little out.
He could be juicy.
He could be juicy.
But he could be astringent and a little bitter.
Yeah,
okay.
True.
So we don't know. Number two, Hillary Clinton. She's a native of Illinois, born in Chicago. Now, hers, I thought, was really fascinating. The state flower of Illinois is the genus Viola, okay? Mm-hmm. There's an expression, shrinking violet, right? Now, you would never, never describe Hillary Clinton as a shrinking violet, right?
Well, if Bernie Sanders keeps holding so true in the polls,
right,
it could be true.
Now, the violet also can be a pest, mm-hmm. right? It's highly invasive.
It's also very tender.
It can be tender.
It's a tender plant that is easily damaged.
It is easily damaged,
but it
also
grows everywhere.
Exactly. So it might be an appropriate flower for Hillary.
Right, buy that.
Okay. Ben Carson. Ben Carson's a native of Michigan. Michigan's flower is the apple blossom, Malus domestica. Now, that's so American.
Right.
Johnny Appleseed.
Lots of disease. He's a doctor.
A lot of problems with apples, but also kind of think of it as our national fruit.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, to me, it's so American. When I think of an American fruit, I think of apple.
Yeah.
What do you think, Robin?
I agree.
Okay. Next, we come to Donald Trump. Okay, Donald Trump is a native of New York, New York City, born in Queens. New York state flower is the genus Rosa.
Well, like Lincoln said, you can think of the thorn, or you can think of the bush with the thorn.
Right. You know? Is it a bush with thorns, or is it a flower? You know,
is it a thorn with bush with roses?
Exactly. So
Trump might have something to say about bush.
He might.
Yeah.
And he has. So I chose an orange rose to represent him.
Yeah. Right.
Because of that tan?
Because of that tan and that hair. So, you know, stay tuned for that. Okay, John Kasich. A lot of people don't know that he's still running. As of today, he's not giving up.
No.
Okay? He's a native of Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania's state flower is the Mount Laurel, otherwise known as Kalmia latifolia.
I think that's actually a great image for him. Because it is a strong, resilient, native shrub that flowers so beautifully when
and delicately.
It flowers. And delicately.
It's not a pushy kind of, you know, in-your-face kind of flower like a rose or a peony. It's evergreen. It has other attributes, right? Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
It's interesting when it's not in flower. Not a lot of rose bushes can say that.
No.
And who wants a violet when it's not in bloom?
Right.
Right?
Is it kind of a blue collar of the flowers?
I guess.
It's tried and true.
It's tried and true.
Like, it's stable. It's always
kind of self-sufficient.
Sufficient. Right.
Yeah.
So it's a good foundation planting.
It's good. Jeb Bush, native Texan.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the state flower of Texas is the Texas bluebonnet, which is in the genus Lupin.
Right.
Right. That's kind of wild, too. Grows quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
Grows in lots of other places besides Texas.
But also
Texas.
Kind of fussy at the same time. If it's not in the right spot, right?
Now, he's probably now more associated with Florida than Texas.
Because of his governorship.
Yeah. Right. But I think lupins are sweet.
But the bush family, you can't ignore.
Is ubiquitous.
The bush
lupins.
Family.
If lupins are happy.
So Texas.
They will
spread
everywhere. Okay. Number seven, Bernie Sanders. Now, Bernie was actually born in Brooklyn, New York, but I decided to represent him with Vermont's state flower because I feel that he's much more associated with Vermont than with New York
right.
at this point.
Well, the Brooklyn Flower is Forsythia.
Right. Which, again, can also be... Some people love it. Some people hate it, like Bernie.
But here's the thing with Forsythia. You are so excited to see it come April. At the end of winter, there it is, blooming its head off. And you're so thankful for that new change, right? The
yes,
new change.
It's a sign. It's a sign of spring.
Right.
But I will argue that red clover.
The Vermont flower.
The Vermont, such a practical thing. It's Trifolium pratens.
Right.
It supports livestock.
Right.
You know, the dairy industry, the cows, right. they're eating clover.
Nitrogen fixing
plant. Yeah. There's a lot going on underground with that plant.
It's true.
So Bernie might...
Interesting.
I thought Bernie might be better represented by the clover. Okay, now lastly, we go to Ted Cruz. Not an American native born, okay?
Right.
Nothing wrong with that. That's me too. He's actually born in Calgary, Alberta, and Alberta's provincial flower is the wild rose, mm-hmm. which I think Ted Cruz...
Is a good wild rose, actually.
He's a wild card.
Uh-huh.
You know, he might be thorny. He might...
But
we don't know.
He's... the wild rose always blooms.
Yeah.
You know, no matter
also
where
independent,
it is.
Self-sufficient.
Yeah. But what are we going to do now if we get the dark horse of Mike Bloomberg?
Right. He's from Boston. Okay, let me look that up
but
right now.
But let me just make a really bad pun, right? If Bloomberg wins, he's going to bloom the berg.
Hmm. Okay. Yes, he will. Right on. Okay, so I believe he was born in Massachusetts. I think he's a Boston boy. Massachusetts flower is called the Mayflower.
Yeah.
Of course, otherwise known as Epigea repens. Okay? Don't know it. I've never planted it.
Well, that's how a lot of people don't know Mike Bloomberg. But
right.
we'll see what happens.
That seems appropriate. We will update you when we get his official notice that he's running. Now, I wanted to end the show with a little quiz, okay? And by the way, all this information came from the website of the U.S. National Arboretum, which is such a great place and underappreciated in our nation. It's located in the nation's capital. It's a great botanical garden arboretum. So here's
I spent every weekend there as a kid.
Yeah,
when
incredible
I was in Washington.
Place.
Yep.
So here's our quiz for our listeners, okay? And you guys can post it on Facebook or on Twitter or on Instagram. Let us know if you know the answer to this question. One state lists a state flower that is not a flower at all. Do you know which state that is? Okay?
I might know.
All right, don't answer it, Robin.
I'm not going to answer it.
We can talk privately about that. So
it might be on a stamp.
Yeah.
Robin just gave you a great clue. All right. So anyway, thank you all for listening to We Dig Plants. Robin, thanks for being on the show, coming out on this cold February day.
Thanks.
On your day off.
And thanks for sharing your information. I think it's fascinating when people pay attention to the symbolism of America. And you've like spent your
lifetime.
Entire life. Paying attention to the mint and the national parks, and it's fun. It's really great.
It also helps with your SAT.
It does.
I mean, there's so many times when there's a famous person's name who gets dropped, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember him from a stamp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More
yeah.
than a coin, because, you know, you can celebrate a lot more people on a stamp than circulating coins.
Yeah. Anyway, it's great America ephemera, and I think more people need to be paying attention to it.
Thanks. So anyway, you've been listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. The show has been written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please remember to join our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc., We Dig Plants, or follow us on Twitter at We Dig Plants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows. And of course on Instagram, where you can see awesome pictures of these presidential portraits. That can be found at Groundworks Gardens NYC. Thanks for listening. See you in the garden.
Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I'm listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.